a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Monday, May 12th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Ruby Walsh reacts to the breaking news in racing as Rachel Blackmore announces her retirement from the sport. Austin O'Malley reflects on two epic football provincial finals. Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly round up all the big League of Ireland and Premier League talking points, while Neil Tracy chats rugby as the URC playoff picture becomes a little bit clearer. Plus, we'll round up our weekend sporting highlights and go through the rest of today's sports news headlines. If you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome along to the show. Welcome along to an hour of sport. Good evening. Alan Cawley, how's the form?
I'm great, Shane. How are you?
I'm very well, very well. Austin O'Malley, keeping well?
Yeah, really, really good. Energised, I think, after the weekend, after watching all that, what played out on the Clonus and Croker and across the divide. It was incredible. So, yeah, really, really looking forward to the rest of the championship as well.
Plenty of drama, both in Gaelic football and association football and elsewhere. However, big, big news. Just before we came on air, Ruby Walsh joins us now on the line because jockey Rachel Blackmore has announced her retirement after a 16-year career in the saddle. The Tipperary rider won the Grand National in 2021 on Manila Times, as well as the Cheltenham Gold Cup on Appleutara in 2022. In doing so, she became the first female jockey to win the races. The 35-year-old had 18 victories in total at the Cheltenham Festival, most recently on Bobolinger last March, and was also the first ever woman to be leading jockey at Prestbury Park 5 years ago. As I mentioned, Ruby Walsh does join us on the line. To react to this news, this shock news, Ruby?
Possibly, Shane. You keep saying first, but actually she's the only, and the only woman to have won a Grand National, a Gold Cup, a champion hurdle, a state mayor's hurdle, a champion chase, and to be the only woman to be leading rider at the Cheltenham Festival. Rachel Blackmore is unique, Shane, and shock news, I suppose. Rachel is 36, a surprise more so than a shock. Definitely not shocked that she's retired, but probably surprised, and I'm delighted that she has retired on her terms and the sport hasn't retired her.
Very much so. How will the sport reflect on Rachel? Obviously, outstanding achievements. And as you mentioned, she was a trailblazer for female jockeys as well. But in a way, her most or her greatest achievement was she just broke down those barriers that perhaps we won't be talking about being a female jockey or male jockey, just a jockey. And that's what she achieved in her success.
Yeah, but I think Rachel Blackmore is unique, and I think it'll always be a female rider. Being a national hunt jockey is not an easy life. It's a tough sport, and Rachel was unique because, like, winning is fine, competing is great, and men and women do get to compete on a level playing field, but it's the physicality, it's the falling, it's the thumps off the ground, it's the speed at which you're, the impact, and it's being able to pick yourself up. And Rachel Blackmore was unique in that sense. Rachel Blackmore could fall better and get up quicker than most men. And that's what made her different. She was just unique. She was like an elastic band and so resilient, so tough. And I think she's unique. And whilst she broke the glass ceilings and proved that women can do it, I don't know how many women there are in the world that are like Rachel Blackmore.
No, it is outstanding achievements. What were her most redeeming, I suppose, qualities? As a, like you mentioned, resilience, but in terms of the successes, the champion chase in 24, two champion hurdles, a Grand National, a Gold Cup, a Stayers hurdle, like as a jockey, when you saw her ride, like what stood out to you?
Rachel did what all top sports people do, and that's she made very few mistakes. That's the difference. It's not that the top people do anything different or better than anybody else. It's just that they make fewer mistakes. They get it wrong less often than everybody else. And that's what Rachel was able to do. She got it. She didn't get it wrong. She was very cool under pressure. She was calculated in what she was doing. And she just didn't get it wrong. And that's the big difference. And I'm sure Alan and Austin would agree. That is the biggest difference in sport. It's just not making mistakes. And that's where most people go wrong. And Rachel was able to make fewer mistakes. That's what made her so good. She made the fewest mistakes.
Which of her many achievements stand out most to you, Ruby?
I thought she was brilliant on a blue tile in the Gold Cup. I thought she was very good on Honeysuckle when she won the Mayor's Hurdle, more so than the Champion Hurdles, because Honeysuckle was on the decline at that point. And then Manila Times in a Grand National. I mean, like, to win a Grand National is incredible, but I still think, I looked at her getting falls and thought, oh, I need to watch her get up. And I've watched her come back from a pretty horrific hip injury. And then to watch her come back this year, I think this year she proved more to me about herself than any of those victories. She got a fall in Killarney last August time. I think she described it as a neck injury. But if a national hunt jockey walks around for 3 months in a neck brace, you can be damn sure there's something broken in their neck. She wasn't wearing it as a fashion item. And then the season took off, and she's like any sports person. And being a jockey, you play for pay. So you're out, there's no salary, you're out, the rides are gone, someone else is riding them. And she worked herself back into the position that was hers and came back to Cheltenham this year and won an air of entitlement and won on Bob Olinger. With all she had achieved, she still had to start again. And she did, and she got herself back to the very top. And I think that takes, I admire that in people. I think that takes doing. And I think whilst it mightn't go down as her greatest ever achievement, for someone looking in from the outside, or a professional looking at a former professional looking at someone like her, I think to take that criticism, to take that dent in confidence and get yourself back to where you were, yeah, I'd admire that.
Absolutely remarkable stuff. Listen, Ruby, thanks so much for taking the call. You'll be back with us presenting the show tomorrow, so we will speak to you again tomorrow. Gents, as Ruby outlined there, just her resilience as a sports person is just, it's absolutely outstanding, awesome. And as well, what he mentioned, so little room for mistakes.
Yeah, and like what Ruby said there in terms of what separates the good from the great is that ability to be able to perform, I suppose, when the game is at its highest and when the game comes calling. And like he talked there about just her coolness and her calmness in those moments and all those rides, like, and her ability to execute under pressure is incredible. That's one part of it. And then I suppose you're thinking of the growth and the resilience of her throughout her career in terms of where she's come from, starting off, I think, under Shark Hanlon, point to point and all of that. So you've got all that in the mix. But the bit that I love about her is, and again about any sports person, is the quality of her character and the way she carried herself and how authentic she was. And anytime you heard her speak, you know, she had an ability to connect with people and inspire people, and very, very grounded. And you can see even after, you know, all those wins, she remained that way. So I just think she's Ruby says she's unique. She's a game changer, I think, in that she has smashed glass ceilings for females in her profession, but not alone there, across the divide as well. I remember being involved, I think it was 2021, was it the Grand National when she won it? I remember being involved with a ladies football team at the time, and just watching that together, we it was a moment. And to see the impact it had actually on a group of young girls, you know, they were just so rooting for her, to see someone do that, and the inspiration they drew from that as well. So not alone in like the racing sort of world, but I think across the divide in terms of the impact on female sports people, she her legacy will last the test of time.
Yeah, so transformational. I know you're a big racing fan, Alan. A genuine legend.
An all-time great, Shane, yeah. And you don't say those kind of words lightly, to be fair to her. And what I love about it, everybody will speak about the fact that a female jockey doing these things, she was just an unbelievable jockey.
Yeah.
Because when you think of the fact that obviously she's gone up against the men, level playing field, it's absolutely incredible, her achievements. And to be winning the races that she was winning on, some of the horses that she was winning on, riding out for obviously a lot for Henry the Bromhead, a lot for Willie as well. She's just been an absolute phenomenon. And I would echo everything that Austin said in terms of her as a person and a character, the way she carried herself throughout, always with a bit of class. And a lot of people wouldn't even recognise, because obviously the fact that she would wear the helmet and she's well protected. I remember being down in Kildare Village one day, and she was sitting amongst, we were just keeping her distance, but I was kind of, I recognised who she was, but I kind of, it just caught me kind of, not by surprise, but just, I was drawn by the fact that we were in kind of sitting in a place having lunch, and she was having lunch with her friends, but nobody knew who she was. And I found this was amazing. And this is when she was at the height of her success, winning Grand Nationals and Champion Hurdles and the biggest races of them all. And I spent about 20 minutes, half an hour, just observing this kind of scenario, the way it played out. And I just remember thinking, it's absolutely incredible that so many people don't even realise that this is probably one of the best jockeys that we've ever had. So yeah, she goes out with an unbelievable legacy. And I hope, as Ruby said, the fact that she's gone out in her terms, I think, is a big thing as well in the racing world. We all know how difficult that is. So yeah, she'll be remembered fondly by everyone, but such a legacy that she leaves, brilliant.
No, absolutely, an absolute legend of the sport, and we'll have more on that on tomorrow's show as well. As mentioned, Ruby will be back. Awesome, we are going to chat Gaelic games very shortly, but before we do, passed by our weekend sporting highlights. Briefly, Alan, your weekend sporting highlight, because I think I have a feeling I know what Austin's is going to be, so I might just segue into our gacha.
I do have three or four, but briefly, yeah, I'm just going to name the names. But so, someone who I would actually hold in the same kind of category and bracket in terms of the classiness of Rachel Brackmore is Michael Murphy. I love Michael Murphy, and what he did on Saturday evening, I was watching the game. I watched the two games over the weekend, but particularly Murphy, to be out of the game for 2 years. And he was, I would have been saying these things about him 2 years ago when he was finishing up, but for him to come back and have the impact that he has, and again, all down to how he carries himself as well, obviously the conditioning he's in, all those things, they're all great lads in terms of their fitness levels and dedication to put into that, but the way he carries it is unbelievable as a talisman for that county. And everybody speaks about Jim McGuinness, but he's right up there with Jim McGuinness as well in terms of the impact that he's having. So to see him back doing what he's doing is absolutely brilliant. Ger Brennan as well, I have to give a mention to, because I know I had Austin nailed down for the Dubs job, the next Dubs job, but I'm afraid Jared has afterwards gone in as
a favourite. I just like, there's no breaking news from Dublin GA. Desi Farrell is still managing them into.
I'm allowed to say these things.
Thanks,
Austin can't and you can't. I'm allowed to say them. But no, I actually said this about Gerard Brennan. I think last year when they got to the final, I definitely think he'll be a Dublin manager, and he will be one day. I've no doubt about that. But for him to achieve what he has with Louth, and yesterday to top it off, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Then I will go to my own sports shed. Eberici Eze, my favourite. Another two at the weekend, coming up to the cup final at the weekend as well. Brilliant player. And I've a major down. I haven't given you a negative in a long time. I've given
go
you
on,
lots of highlights.
It's allowed.
The Nottingham Forest chairman coming on the pitch berating the manager was an absolute disgrace. And I'm sure we'll get into it in the football chat, but that really disappointed me, especially when you think of the job that Nuno has done as well.
Okay. No, last minute winner in Talca Park is a sporting highlight for you, Alan, no?
That's
so I wanted you to bring it up, not me. So,
I'm saving back for the football chat. Kurt McEnroy, best midfielder in Ireland, apparently.
Sorry, we're going to have to move on to Gaelic football before our Pat's supporting producer here just lowers my fader remotely. You should start with the football and ended with the Gaelic football, because like Alan then, perfect, nice little segue into Austin O'Malley at the Gaelic football.
We all know Austin's waiting to get in, don't worry.
Listen, I'm assuming your weekend sporting highlights centred around two cracking matches. That was really a good good showcasing of the new rules, to put it lightly.
Oh, brilliant. Like, when you think about, I suppose, the impact that it's had on the game, and, you know, if you're Jim Gavin or any member of the FRC, you know, come Monday morning, you're sitting back and you're thinking, wow, like, they've had a huge, huge impact. They've, you know, they've resuscitated the game in many respects when you look at what played out in Croker and in Clonus over the weekend. Mm. Like, there were two absolutely absorbing contests. Like, when you think of the Ulster final, just a mammoth, mammoth game, and you know, a game that was punctuated with so many big moments. That man that you've mentioned already, Michael Murphy, just a colossus, but right throughout, huge. And then into Croke Park on Sunday, like to watch that game and to see, you know, 65 or odd thousand people crammed in there, the colour, the noise, the energy, the anticipation from both sets of fans. Just incredible the way it played out. So huge, huge weekend, you know.
Yeah, no, it seemed like a almost All-Ireland final kind of atmosphere in Croke Park, and I was only around the area, I wasn't at the match, but I was kind of even just around the area. And listen, I know Alan tongue-in-cheek is declaring Ger Brennan the next Dublin manager, maybe in a few years down the line, it's Desi's for the moment, but on a serious note, like, his stock has risen as a manager, and it's an unbelievable achievement for Louth, and this is something that's been in the pipeline. We see the minor and under 20 success that's there at Louth. This is a special time to be a fan of Louth Gaelic football.
Oh, it is, yeah, and Ger referenced that last night, I suppose, in terms of all the great work that's gone on within Louth, and that has gone on over the years, because these things don't happen by chance. Anybody that's involved in sport or in Gaelic games, or indeed in any sport, knows that you know, these things, they're not happenstance, or they don't, there isn't a huge degree of luck in them. It's actually the work that's put in at underage and the grassroots. And then obviously Ger coming in, his background, obviously, you know, having played with Dublin, multiple All-Ireland winner, multiple All-Ireland winner with club as well in that. And the job he has done there and what he's assembled, you know, in a back room, putting around with Noel Moyna and that. And really, you can see that he's really connected with the group. And, you know, he's referenced different things about that. They weren't happy with the status quo, and their third Leinster final on the bounce, two under Ger, obviously. But to breach that gap, you know, you can talk all you want about it, but, you know, it's a significant piece of history. 68 years they were waiting. And in the manner they done it then, they were superb in terms of that second half and closing the game out. So Ger is a brilliant, brilliant character. You know, obviously in his professional role, he's head of sport up in Gaelic Games in UCD. But he has developed himself as a coach. He has, you know, obviously a number of different roles taken. He was in Kildare with a club. He was out with Bray Emmett. So he's built himself into
that. Did you see
position.
His leadership qualities? Apologies to cut across you, just because I know you would have played with him at Vincent's in your Dublin club football days. Like, did you see those qualities even when he was a younger man as a player?
Oh, without doubt, without doubt. He's a guy that's, you know, full of personality and character as well. And he's a guy that's, you know, has great nature as well. So you can really see how that he would have that ability to connect with players as a coach as well. But on field, he was a real, you know, he was a real leader and a marshal as well. Like, you know, arguably, if you go back to when Dublin, you know, had that breakthrough under Pat Gilroy, like, he was, you know, chief instigator back there in defence, and he dropped off as that kind of, you know, holding six or so on. So he was marshalling a lot there, and he gave them a brilliant, brilliant platform. So I think he's always shown that type of character that he'd go on and develop himself in that type of a role. And it's easy to see why he has been successful.
Well, we can hear some reaction from the Loud camp. Here's Loud's Craig Lennon.
Just look around, the stadium's covered in red. There's tears. There's just overwhelming emotion. It's unbelievable. And to be a part of it is incredible.
After losing the last two Leinster finals, did you think maybe you'd never get over the line, or did you keep that belief going right throughout?
No, I think we'd keep the belief. We had a good All-Ireland campaign last year. Just came up short against Donegal. We weren't good enough on the day, but the squad's there. I think we've just gotten stronger and stronger. We've gotten brought lads in. We've got Andy McDonald back, that just brings experience, and just lads back. Emma Carroll, and just the squad's only getting stronger. You see the work that's going on in the counties, 20s, have a Leinster. Minors are in a final now next week, so no doubt in my mind that we'd be back here, and no doubt we'd get a wee bit of silver along the line.
Talk to us about today, because you need goals invariably to win matches like this. Your goal was quite something. Talk us through it, or what you can recall of it.
I think there was around 33, 34 minutes left, I'm not sure. Running down the hooter and just spotted the gap.
Craig Lennon giving it back for Sam Mulroy. Clearly a game plan to slow matters down when they have the possession. Try and draw Meath out of their defensive zone. 1, 2, 3, 4 Loud players are in around the small rectangle.
I was thinking about tapping it over for the point, but I'd got more space than I thought, and the corner was just asking to be hit, I suppose. So just let loose, let go, and thankfully it went in.
Here comes a great run by Craig Lennon, heading towards the 20-30. Oh! Unbelievable! Oh. Now that's a goal! Craig Lennon has lit up Croke Park, and no matter where you are in the world, India, New York, downtown Dunshaughlin or Drogheda, that will lift your heart, because right now that is one of the best goals I've seen. Craig Lennon.
Is it the best goal you ever scored?
Yeah, probably, I suppose, biggest occasion, and so that adds to it, so yeah, it probably is.
Yeah, and in terms of the game, obviously Meath played their part, but it was a cracking contest overall, wasn't it? Yeah. What was it like to play in?
Tough going, just the noise. When Meade get that goal, Matthew Costello gets that goal, you go a point behind, I think, or 2 points behind, and noise from the Meade fans, daunting, but like, you couldn't ask for much more. The games you want to be playing, and really, really good experience, and hopefully we'll enjoy it.
And so many of the young lads, you know, lads like yourself, would have grown up perhaps hearing about what happened in 2010, that famous day, the Joe Sheridan goal. Obviously for you players, it's a different era now, but was that playing on your minds at all, what happened, that Loud maybe were wronged back then?
No, as you've said, like, I think I was 8, 9 years old at the time, so I remember the day, but don't remember exactly what happened and that kind of stuff, so no, it wouldn't have played on our minds too much. Ger had us well drilled and well coached and kind of how to avoid that sort of stuff, so no.
I think it might have somewhat banished the ghosts anyway, but however.
Absolutely.
Craig Lennon...
one of the websites, I saw a brilliant photo where they had the cup just over the goal line.
Oh, there was. It was one of the Loud players, yeah. Actually. I'm not sure who it was who threw. He throws the cup over the
That's it, dead and buried now.
That's it. That's a tongue in cheek. And that's proper. That's I enjoy that, actually. Craig Lennon talks about an unbelievable goal and what a strike it was. And an historic weekend for Loud. A big weekend for Donegal as well. Small margins and goal and goal chances. Probably the difference ultimately between the sides.
Yeah, look, this was just a titanic struggle again. Like, it was such compelling viewing and so gripping. Cagey enough early on, but Donegal settled, and like at one point in that first half went 6 or 7 up. But like, it was just literally like two heavyweights again, if you want to use that analogy. You know, Armagh were just counter-punching. They were keeping in there the whole time, tagging on, you know, very little at the break. There was only three between them again at the break. Came back out, Donegal stretched it again, but the goals were key. Yeah, the goals were key. And McFadden's goal, obviously key, and Kieran Moore's late on. And Armagh had goal chances as well, but just didn't execute. So that's something they'll probably go away from and look at this in terms of, you know, they got those chances. But it was such a titanic battle when you went into extra time and that. And it looked like it was going to go to penalties again. But Donegal just in the end had that little bit of composure and they managed to see it out. O'Donnell's winner, obviously, at the end. And then that phase of play down along the sideline, Stephen McManam trying to get the ball back out to the, what you'd say, the weak side to get it back out the pitch. So there was so much. It was just an absorbing and compelling encounter, and both teams will take so much from that going away. Like, you know, Armagh, obviously they feel a little bit of a sting, but they played some brilliant football. And you know, they looked like, I think it was 3 minutes into extra time was the first time they went ahead, and they looked like they were going to pop on again. But again, the character, we know that Jim McGuinness has sort of, you know, built into the DNA this Donegal team, served them well in the end there. So like, you would not rule the two of these, you know, if the draw was kept them apart, that they'd end up in an All-Ireland final down the line, you know, to be a classic again or something.
Yeah, just judging by the celebrations of Jim, of Murphy, McBearty, is this the sweetest of the three Ulster titles for Donegal?
Yeah, I like, they cherish it so much, and it's, you know, you can see what an Ulster title means to them. And, you know, to do it back to back in Ulster is a big thing. Mm. You know, it really does show that you're about your business. And it's like, it's such a tough competition to win. And again, I suppose you had the Michael Murphy factor coming back again. That made it that little bit extra special. But I just think the game in its totality, when you look through it, the amount of moments that were in it, when, you know, even Michael Murphy afterwards said, I thought we were in, we were out, we had it, we were gone. But just, I think, the most pleasing factor from them will be the character that they showed, and to find those couple of scores in those moments and not to break under the pressure that Armagh put them under in those phases. And arguably, like you probably said, they should have closed out in full time, but they reset and they found it and got across the line. So it's a huge, and I was just thinking of it afterwards, like that, a game like that is worth about 4 weeks training to you in terms of what you get out of it from a physiological perspective, a mental perspective and so on. So they're both are equally well set up heading into their group, their group stages.
That's fascinating, actually, remark there. Four weeks in, because just the energy and everything.
The energy and the intensity of it. I think just collectively, when you look at when you get from it, like they have what, 90 minutes of absolutely,
That's something that really interests me, because you're obviously gone through something similar in terms of the season and trying to manage workloads and blocks of training camps and matches and all that kind of stuff. Jim McGuinness made a comment afterwards in his interview that the Ulster Championship is like the Munster Championship in the hurling, and it's something that ignites the people. In terms of them going forward, because it's so difficult and so hard, do you think it could be a hindrance on them down the line?
Yeah, I don't think so, because with the way and the amount of scaffolding that's put around teams now in terms of sports science and that, it's and they will have this all factored in terms of the periodization of their workload and all of that, and what comes afterwards in terms of the rest and the recovery. And as I said, there's so much scaffolding put around guys, and there's so much monitoring and metrics as well now that you're able to see, you know, what we call, you know, positive or negative spikes in workloads, and you can manage those accordingly to avoid soft tissue injuries and all of that. So, I mean, I don't think so. I think what you get from it is, you know, you get from a football perspective in terms of you've had a serious test. All the key pillars of your game have been tested. But physiologically as well, you get a bounce from it because obviously you've been taken to a place physically that you just kind of get in training.
Okay.
You know, you see the 90 minutes or so with Michael Murphy going off a little bit of cramp, McHugh and these, you know, you've pushed the physical boundaries. When you get a chance to recover and regenerate the body, and what we get is that what you call that super compensation. You come back at a higher level in terms of fitness, that fitness fatigue model. That's where they'll get a huge bounce.
Just a final one to wrap up our conversation, Austin. We mentioned about Donegal and the victory, and I know you touched on the positives from Armagh's performance, and we emphasise such small margins. How much will the defeat hurt Armagh, considering now they've Galway, Dublin, Derry to contend with in a group stage, or will they be able to just harness those positives? Because at the end of the day, that famine continues without an Ulster title. I know they're all Ireland champions before fighting from Armagh takes in, but...
Yeah, and look, that's what's facing Kieran McGeaney and his backroom team now in terms of how do you frame this going forward, and how do you, you know, bed some, you know, the correct messages in with your team that you're taking the right things from. There are so many positives in it in terms of, and I think there's one in this that's maybe been lost as well, but you still have the Rian O'Neill factor to come back in. And this is going to be huge coming down the line in terms of the way the game has opened up and his ability to kick two-pointers and that. So, you know, that was a serious test the weekend. But I think if they're heading at the next group stages, and they have the likes of this guy to unleash, it kind of can regenerate and freshen things up. And you can kind of psychologically say you can get a bounce from that. It is a tough group, but if they're going to go the distance, and they have last year in the locker, they're a very mature side. They have a really, really good back room in terms of being able to frame this right so they get the bounce from it. And I think they probably will.
Okay. Great. So, Fawcett O'Malley, thank you as always. We will continue our Gaelic football chat tomorrow. Former Offaly star Nigel Dunn will be with us to review all of the Tulchan Cup action. However, we are taking a short ad break and then turning our attention to association football, both Premier League and League of Ireland, in the company of Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly.
Game on. Association football.
Now, Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly are with us to chat through all the Premier League and League of Ireland talking points. Stephen Kelly, if I come to you first, we've heard plenty from Alan Cawley and his weekend sporting highlights, and none of which were surrounding Trent Alexander-Arnold and his brilliant cameo for Liverpool, however, the big narrative. How do you weigh in on it, Stephen? Boo or no boo?
No boo. It's odd. Like, listen, I get the fans are entitled to opinion, and this is the whole thing that's being spread around. You know, they're entitled to feel how they feel. No one should question it. Of course you should question it. There's a young player that's absolutely been one of the best players in the club's history, won everything. And yeah, they're disgruntled because he's gone on a free, because he's had his contract run down. I blame that on the club for not offering the contract they should have offered him in the first place. And yeah, they have all the right, but listen, he's leaving the club regardless of what you think, and he's not going on. He's not signing for Manchester United. It's not Sol Campbell signing for Arsenal. It's, you know what I mean. It's Trent Alexander. He's gone to Real Madrid. He's got one of the biggest clubs in the world and world football. And regardless of what you think, the institution Anfield is and Liverpool is, if Real Madrid come calling, there's not many people that turn that opportunity down. And I think it's shambolic that he's getting booed like that. They're entitled to it. But I suppose we're entitled to our opinion about.
No, that's fair. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, absolutely, Alan Cawley.
I would agree totally with Stephen. I was actually disappointed in it, to be honest with you, Shane, because he has been such a brilliant player. And again, if Real Madrid or Barcelona come calling, he's after giving them 8 years service. They've won everything. It's not like he's going to Everton or going to Chelsea or going to Man City, as Stephen pointed out. And maybe then you might be annoyed with him or whatever. But he's allowed to go on and further his career and better his career after the service that he's given. Of course, you can't tell people how to behave, unfortunately. And there is a lot of idiots that be involved in football, especially in the crowd at many places. But I just thought, and what disappointed me more than anything else, Shane, Liverpool fans are very knowledgeable and always are a bit classy kind of in what they do and how they conduct themselves. I just thought there was no need for it whatsoever. As I said, I thought all this was put to bed after he scored the goal against Leicester there a couple of weeks ago, and he kind of had his moment with the fans, and everybody knew he was leaving. It shouldn't have come as a surprise. Everybody kind of knew. There was a question mark around Van Dijk and Salah, and there was always the hope that seemed a bit more 50-50 and kind of probably even more 70-30 towards them staying. But we always felt when Real Madrid were knocking on the door for Trent that he was going to go. So I thought it was very disappointing, yeah, I have to be honest.
Yeah, similar to Steve McManaman back in 1999. But I feel if Trent had scored, I think everyone in the stadium would have been cheering him, but however. Moving on, defeats for both Manchester United, Alan, and indeed Spurs. I want to get your thoughts on this, Alan, first, because I might need to give a right reply to Stephen Kelly here. Who would be the more disappointed out of those set of fans, considering there's a small matter of Europa League final next week?
Well, the interesting thing about this is Crystal Palace have the FA Cup final next week as well. So I'm looking at this in terms of your preparation for the biggest match of the season. And it was like night and day from Glasner and Postecoglou. Glasner even spoke in the interview afterwards about brilliant preparation, putting in a strong team performance, playing so well, and carrying that momentum into next week's final. I thought he was absolutely brilliant. Contrast that to Postecoglou, who has been a shambles all season. When you look at it in terms of the position that they're in, the amount of goals they've conceded, even you're looking at it yesterday, Crystal Palace had an expected XG of 3.2 yesterday. They had 22 shots, 9 on target, 7 big chances, which means almost like 7 one-on-ones. Spurs had 1 shot on target. And if you're expecting a team then to rock up to a European final next week and just turn it on, it doesn't happen like that, Shane. Now, there is a chance, obviously it's 50-50. It helps that they're playing Man United, who were in a similar position, that they're a bit of a shambles at the moment as well. So it is very much a 50-50 game, and it could get away with it, and he could win next week, Postecoglou. But what I've watched all season from him and the way he sets up his team, as I said, contrast the even it was a good example of the team we were playing yesterday, how well coached, how well drilled Crystal Palace are under Glasner. It's just, it beggars belief, it really does. And as I said, he might get away with it in the game next week, but I'm looking at it over a pattern of 38 league games, 20 defeats, and then almost having the audacity in an interview afterwards when someone questions him, like almost playing the victim. How can you question me? He should be questioned on every single performance that they've put in all year. It's been an absolute shambles of a season for Spurs.
Stephen, would you be as concerned as Alan?
Yeah, I would be concerned. The only listen, every time I watch Tottenham play, I think they can get beaten. I was watching the game against Bodo Glimt. I felt we could lose this match, and they didn't. The only thing shining light, and there's not many shining lights coming out of Spurs, is that I think they've solely focused on Europe for so long now that, and this is no excuse because the players have been shambolic. Like 20 league defeats in the Premier League is absolutely diabolical. Like, there's no escaping that. It's diabolical. Regardless, you could have been putting out, your whole team is missing, and I know that was for a lot of seasons, it seemed to be the case for Spurs. They still had sufficient of players to get the results. Like, look how bad the teams that went down. And Tottenham, like, Ipswich had 22 losses, Tottenham have had 20. Like, we're talking about some of the worst three teams in the Premier League's history getting relegated, just the way they played and how they felt like there was no fight. And Spurs are one place above them, so there's no excuse in that. But I feel for a long, long time now that everything's been pinned on that. And like, whatever message the manager's portraying to those players is that it doesn't matter about the Premier League. And that shouldn't be the case. Absolutely shouldn't be the case. Every Spurs manager at this point in the history of the club would be sacked by now. They wouldn't have a job. They'd be gone. Absolutely gone. And I think he's hanging on by dear life on the basis of this Europa League. And maybe he can, if he wins something, he can throw over that we had injuries and he may get away with it. I'm not too sure he does, but it's pinning a lot on one game, and it would be the most Spursy thing in the history of football that they beat Man U 3 times and they lose them in the final.
But regardless of that, right, Stephen, if you're a well-coached, well-drilled team and obviously you're losing games, and then they say, well, we'll focus on Europe towards the end and the carrot that's dangling in front of you with the Champions League. Mm. And because of the teams that they're facing, there's a good chance that if they play well, they might get to a final, and here we are now, they're in the final. But if you're coaching a team properly and you're doing the right things in terms of setting standards, regardless if there's a drop off in terms of their mind might focus on a cup, you'd still go out in the league games and might be difficult to beat because you're still doing the right things in terms of how the manager is coaching you. Every time I watched them, they're so open, there's gaps everywhere. They're like Spence yesterday didn't know whether he was coming or going at left full, and Munoz had a field day down the right hand side. There's never a plan of action in terms of out of possession. It's all focused on maybe a bit of individual brilliance when in possession. There are shambles, and the only one that's going to benefit out of this, if they do win the Europa League next week, and the same can be said for Man United, is either Jim Ratcliffe or Daniel Levy with the money that's on offer. Because Postecoglou won't benefit. He'll be gone, and he should be gone. And Amorim, I think, is close to being gone as well. I know people will say, well, he's only in the door. He's been dreadful as well.
Well, I the strong rumours are suggesting that the man that beat Spurs the weekend is the one that's in prime position to be taking that job. And if he does come in, I'd be hoping bringing Abrishe Eze with him, because that guy is something else. But no, Colin, you're right. Honestly, you're absolutely right. They've been so bad, and I think it is all on the managers, because regardless of how things are going in the league, if you're winning in Europe, you should be able to transform that form into your home games. And listen, I know being the Europa League is a slog. Thursday nights, Sunday nights, it's not easy. Traveling to far-flung parts of Europe, you're trying to get back in recovery. It's not the easiest thing. But when we were at Fulham, we got to the Europa League final, and we finished. This is Fulham. God, how many years ago that was, and we had a tiny squad, literally a tiny squad, nowhere near the money you spent that Spurs have invested in the squad, and we think we still finished in the top 10. Like, and that was with us going to Europe and doing it on a budget, the way, not like Spurs would have done it. Like, and we were still able to, and we started off back in, we played 66 games that season. We started off back in the early qualifying stages of Europa League, and we had the teams drop out of Champions League that year as well. So it wasn't just, you know, you didn't have a solid performance. So there's no excuse for Tottenham to be doing what they're doing in the league. It is, and he should be sacked on the basis of that.
Elsewhere in the Premier League, and all very valid points, and will be very interesting. I'm looking forward to your Europa League preview next week, whenever. You mentioned at the top of the show, Alan, Evangelos Marounakis, the Nottingham Forest owner, coming on to berate Nuno. Now, they did release a statement. Apparently, his anger was with the physio, and there was miscommunication in that regard. But, I mean, Nottingham Forest, seventh at the table, they're already overachieving, are they not?
100%, Shane. Again, going back to even the comments about Trent, this is majorly disappointing, and particularly on Nuno. And we started the show about Rachel Blackmore, and I added in Michael Murphy, and there's a way to conduct yourself and behave yourself. And I thought Nuno's interview after the match last night was absolutely brilliant, because he didn't get embroiled in maybe what the media were looking for as well, and a reaction from him, and he totally kind of dampened down any type of friction between him and the chairman. But inside, he must have been absolutely boiling, to be honest with you, Shane. You don't go on the pitch and start berating him. And he put it down to football's an emotional game, and that's fair enough, it is an emotional game, and sometimes you can overstep the mark, but there has to be a solid line between where the chairman is and where the manager is. And if there's discussions going on behind the scenes, which I'm sure there is in boardrooms or dressing rooms or wherever the case may be, or offices or training grounds, you can't go on the pitch after the match and have a go at the manager. And as you say, they've come out with some sort of excuse or a statement, and it was around the confusion with the injury to Ioane towards the end. But I thought it was absolutely disgraceful from the chairman to do that as well, who by all accounts is quite good behind the scenes from what we're hearing. And they have done a brilliant job, and Nuno as well has done such a brilliant job. He didn't deserve that, Shane. I thought it was totally out of order from the chairman.
Do you know what the funniest thing about the whole situation is? Is that Marounakis, supposedly 4 weeks ago, has stepped back from footballing operations at the club because... So you're going, really? Really? And he's on the pitch today. Like, if you wait for him looking at this and they qualify for a major for Europe, and you're going, like, it's shambolic that he's actually doing that as well. Like, it's a ridiculous situation that he's gotten down to the pitch. So you can't control your emotions to be able to just to get back in. Listen, I get it. There's passion runs deep in him, and he is, you know, he really, really wants the club to succeed, and that was a missed opportunity, especially against Leicester. But for a manager that has got a club that was in the Championship doldrums a few seasons ago to the break of Champions League football, I don't think you conduct yourself in that manner. And like I said, considering he wasn't supposed to be involved in the footballing operations of the club anymore, that kind of goes out the window.
Yeah, no, that's what I found bizarre, considering he has the stake in Olympiacos still. So in theory, it was a random punter going onto the pitch. So, to break.
He actually looked like a random punter as well.
Just before we end our Premier League conversation, who's going to catch Arsenal in the second, Stephen, or will anyone?
Newcastle, hopefully. No, I'm
joking. there is that distinct possibility now.
Eddie Howe's been absolutely amazing. Yeah.
They play each other, don't they? So that's the game. They play next before
Sunday. Sunday half four. Yeah.
So that's the game. If Newcastle can take their form in that, like Tonali, see Tonali the weekend. Like, I know he's had his lull and he's dropped off and the betting scandal and stuff and all, but underneath all that, they've got an absolute player. So yeah, I think Newcastle would be sensational, and it'd be nice for them to catch them. Always wear sports at home.
I'd say Eddie Howe must be in for manager of the year as well, when you think of them winning the cup.
Co-manager with Jason Tindall, but go on.
Maybe he doesn't want it. He will definitely steal his thunder that night, Jason Tindall. 100%. But he must be in the reckoning. He's done a phenomenal job, Eddie Howe, and especially if he leads them even to third, second, wherever, Champions League football, winning the cup as well, beating Liverpool. He's been brilliant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Best of luck to Home Farm Under 12s.
Yes,
Alan, you're in your Home
absolutely.
Farm top.
Off
to good luck.
Yes, Stephen, the next player.
All the best.
Stephen Kelly will be on the line to give the team talk later on. Stephen, thank you for joining us. Alan, best of luck against Sore Celtic. We didn't get to touch on the League of Ireland. We will cover that later on in the week. Actually, just before you go, Alan, League of Ireland, what caught your eye then? Bows for the title now. What's it?
Bows flying.
They've been ahead, very, very briefly. They've been ahead, I think, in 22 minutes, and they've got 15 out of 18 points. It's something along those
football,
lines.
Football, it's bonkers. It really is. But why we love it. And I was in Talca on Friday night. Little bit disappointed with St. Pat's, particularly their second half performance, Shane. That's the second time I've seen that in 2 or 3 weeks now. The same happened in Dalymount a couple of weeks ago. But big win for Shelburne, and badly needed, because for the first time, I think it was 1-6. They needed a reaction. They needed a response. Kerr McEnroy, who's been in the headlines as well, popping up with a big goal for them. So that was huge for them.
No, very much so. I enjoyed the way I posed the question on Bows and you turned it into shells. That's on you, Alan, not me. That's on you.
Well, big win for Bows.
That is true. Okay, great. So for taking a short ad break, turning our attention to rugby, Neil Tracy's going to join us as the URC playoff picture becomes a little bit clearer. Now, RT Sports' Neil Tracy joins us on the line to chat rugby as we reflect on the weekend's URC action. Before we do, some injury update news, I suppose, from Leinster. And not good for Caelan Doris. Leinster and Ireland captain Caelan Doris is to miss up to 6 months of action following surgery on his shoulder. Leinster Rugby issued an injury bulletin this afternoon confirming that the Mayo man will be absent for between 4 and 6 months after last Friday's procedure. The number 8 was among the favourites to captain the British and Irish Lions in their tour of Australia, but he was omitted from the squad announced by Andy Farrell last week due to the injury picked up in the defeat to Northampton Saints in the Champions Cup semi-finals. Before we chat to Neil Tracy, we can hear the thoughts of Leinster coach Tyler Blaindell, who was speaking to Michael Corcoran on that injury.
We all feel, you know, gutted for Caelan. We wanted him for the rest of the season. We wanted him on that Lions tour, and I think he's definitely got the mental attitude to get through the rehab and come back stronger, but it doesn't really hide the disappointment that he's probably feeling and we're all feeling for him.
I know he'll be surrounded by people and the best of people who can help him, but just the mental challenge you've even mentioned, and you know yourself from your previous situation, the mental challenge is a huge thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge thing, and there's never a good time for an injury, but this timing seems particularly cruel. But yeah, again, we'll back Caelan, he'll back himself to come back stronger and find the opportunity in the injury. And we just have to work hard. He'll have to work hard, and we'll see him when he gets back.
Neil, I know you regularly cover the rugby beat, and we talk about the physical, I suppose, recovery from a 6 month injury, but as Tyler touched on there as well, the mental attitude, do you feel Caelan Doris will be able to cope with that?
I do. Oh, I absolutely do, Shane. I really would. Like, it's funny. He's been through, like, for a man who's the last 4 years has been defined by his durability with Ireland. It's kind of something I was saying last week. He's played 44 out of the last 45 Ireland internationals, and he started all but one of those as well. So the last 4 years have been defined by his durability. But I suppose you do have to remember, like, when we were leading into the previous Lions tour in 2021, he wouldn't have been in the picture for that because he had sat out the entire Six Nations campaign. He'd been going through some concussion issues at the time. He took time out of the game to make sure he was all right. And he did spend a large chunk of that season on the sidelines. And ultimately, when he did come back, he came back a better player. He came back a leader. And as I said, went into the Ireland team that summer in 2021 and hasn't left it to this day as well. And he's got to the point where he's now the Ireland captain. That durability of the last 4 years is probably why it is such a blow for him of all people, because he's always been there. He has gone from strength to strength in these last 4 years. And, without being disrespectful to other players, I think he was guaranteed to be the starting number 8 in that test series. And he had a good bet at being the captain as well.
Mm. When we look at the match action then, and I do want to pick your brain on Munster, but just be considering talking about Caelan Doris, just Leinster, a facile run out against Ebrae means they finish top no matter how they fare at home to Glasgow on Saturday. They're booked in for a quarter final at the Aviva Stadium May 31st at 3 p.m. against a team that finishes 8. Is this going to be the most hollow URC victory ever if Leinster do go all the way?
Well, I'm going to stress if they do go all the way, because for the last few years we have kind of assumed that they've come into the latter stages of the URC title run in either first or second place in the table and home advantage all if they stay there, and they haven't gone and done it. They haven't won a piece of silverware in in nearly 4 years, well, in 4 years now, since March of 2021. So I'm not going to make any assumptions anymore that they are going to be lifting silverware at the end of this season. I've done that enough. Ultimately, their seasons are defined by how many trophies they win. And I think, as you say, even if they do go on and lift the URC, you will still all be looking back on the what if of the Champions Cup and team selections and taking points. But look, it's pressure and it's a hole that they've built for themselves, and they have to go on and do it. There is no coming back from it if they don't go on and win the title this year.
So Leinster will face the team that finishes eighth. Currently, Munster. Munster have their fate in their own hands. Level on 46 points with Friday night's visitors to Cork, but behind them the table due to winning fewer matches. That means a win or a draw will keep Benetton ahead, with Cardiff and Edinburgh ready to pick up the scraps of the match no matter who wins. Cardiff also won 46 points, face the Stormers in Cape Town. John Dobson's side are in fifth, guaranteed a playoff place, and can't improve but could slip down the seedings with a defeat. Were you impressed with Munster's performance on Friday, and how much will that kind of, I suppose, harness that good energy into this make or break match now on this coming Friday?
Yeah, I'd say I'd stress I was impressed with the second half in particular. Like the first half at Thomond Park on Friday night was a brilliant game. It was wildly entertaining and it was absolutely bonkers for about a 4 minute spell in the first half, where Munster score a try straight from the kickoff. They give one back to Ulster and then Ulster hand one back to Munster. So they scored some nice tries in the first half, four of them in total, but it probably wasn't as complete a performance as you want. It was a very chaotic kind of performance from both teams, and the Munster lineout didn't help that either. But I would say in the second half, they came out sharp after the break and they just looked far fitter than Ulster. It was something that Ian Costello spoke about afterwards. He thought his team just, they always play at a high tempo and they had the legs to do that for much longer than Ulster did. That would be the part of it that impressed me most. Probably as well the emotional energy of the weekend. I imagine it was a very emotionally intense week down at the Munster HPC last week, with Peter O'Mahony and Conor Murray and Stephen Archer all playing their last games, more than likely their last games at Thomond Park. And that would have been a big part of the week, a big part of the motivation of the week. And they probably have to do something similar this week, because it's, you know, this will be a final opportunity for O'Mahony and Archer in particular, the two Corkmen playing their final games down at Musgrave Park as well. But they can't allow that to get to distract themselves from what this week is about. And this week is about locking in a playoff place and making sure that they're around for not just another week of rugby in the playoffs, but for Champions Cup rugby next season. Because if Munster miss out on Champions Cup rugby and we only have one Irish province playing Champions Cup rugby next season, there is going to be a lot of soul searching done in David Humphrey's office at the IRFU this summer.
Yeah, are there financial ramifications? Because we talk about kind of the finances, and now it's not really on par with, say, Champions League football or Premier League football, or even on a much smaller scale if a League of Ireland club finishes top, and then the financial rewards that would give them. But in terms of rugby and in terms for these provinces, how important is qualification for the Champions Cup?
Yeah, to be honest, I would say, like, obviously there is a massive difference money-wise between Champions Cup and Challenge Cup in one season. But I think, particularly from a Munster point of view, just with the history they have in the competition, for them to miss out you'd worry it might have longer term ramifications than just the amount of money they get from it next season. If you know what I mean, just in terms of trying to bring people in, they're trying to grow the game in the province. They're not, and I think missing out on Champions Cup could have a massive impact on that. But they've plans to play a Champions Cup pool match, presuming they get there, in Portcullis next season, for example, which is a big driver and trying to get more people in through the gates as well. So it would be unthinkable for the province not to be in the top tier of European rugby next season. But at the same time, if they don't pull out a performance this weekend, it is a very realistic prospect.
Trying to pick themselves up again, just emotionally, how difficult is that challenge to get on that level?
It is difficult, and I think we would have seen it, three or four weeks ago when they went out to La Rochelle and pulled off one of the great modern Munster European wins, and a week later looked emotionally drained and emotionally flat when they had to go back to Bordeaux. Now, obviously, the stakes are so different between those two things, where you're talking about two big away matches in France in the Champions Cup knockouts compared to two URC games on home soil in Limerick and in Cork. But the stakes are obviously so high this weekend as well. And the opponents are so dangerous. People would, a lot of people down the years would have written off a side like Benetton, but you can't ignore the fact that Benetton are ahead of Munster in the table right now. They put a big score on Glasgow Warriors last weekend. And even though they were home, they probably weren't expected to come out with such a resounding win against Glasgow, who I know were already secure in the playoffs. But you look at the players that Benetton have in there, particularly that midfield of Tomasa Menoncello and Juan Ignacio Brex, two players who ripped Ireland apart for Italy in Rome earlier on in the Six Nations. And Munster have had defensive issues this season, and if they do not get it right on Friday in Cork, they could be in a lot of trouble.
You're from around those parts. How does a Munster roar of Limerick differ to a Munster roar from Cork in terms of support? Yeah, and sorry, I say that half tongue-in-cheek, but also in terms of the energy of both stadiums to get behind the team.
It's a difficult one because you're talking about two very, very different grounds. The matches down in Musgrave Park are always really enjoyable to go to because obviously it is a smaller ground, but every single time they play there, it is going to be the 8,008 sold out crowd. So there is actually always a really, really good atmosphere down there and a really good buzz. Maybe there might have been a couple of months ago, the last time they were down there when they got handed a really, really bad defeat to Edinburgh when the lineups just completely fell apart. But I think, I mean, particularly this weekend, it's going to be the final outing at Musgrave Park for, you know, one of Cork's favourite rugby sons, Peter O'Mahony. I don't think there's going to be any worry about atmosphere down there this weekend. And I will say on Friday night just gone, 17,000 at Thomond, like plenty of empty space there. But the noise when he scored that try in the second half was just incredible. It was like it was scripted because you had these kids standing right in front of him holding up this King Peter homemade banner as he flung the ball into the crowd to celebrate. And 2 minutes later, I remember Ulster were camped down on the Munster line, almost about to score a try, and Peter O'Mahony was being subbed off at that very moment. The crowd were still celebrating as if a try had been scored while Munster were defending their own line. I was worried for a second Ulster were actually going to score a try and no one in the ground was going to notice because everyone was just watching Peter O'Mahony walking off the pitch. It was a fantastic atmosphere there on Friday night, and I'm expecting there's going to be good voice there in Cork on Friday as well.
Okay, great. So if we're going to leave the conversation there, just to know Connacht and Ulster are both out of contention following defeat at the weekend as well. You can hear more of that on the RT Rugby podcast. Who's on this week now?
TBC.
TBC.
More than likely our good friend Bernard Jackman. We're still putting the final touches on our second guest, but it'll be in your feeds on Wednesday afternoon.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, on that mysterious note, we'll leave it there. Neil Tracy, thank you so much. Beto Da Silva is up next with the new music show, but there's only one place to end. Of course, we started with the news of Rachel Blackmore's retirement from professional racing after 16 years in the saddle. We can hear how that famous Grand National was won back in 2021.
Coming to the second last in the Grand National, Rachel Blackmore jumps to the front on Minella Times, chased by a rank outsider, Balco de Flo. These two are stablemates. One's really fancied, one's a huge outsider. Minella Times at the last from Balco de Flo. Burrow Saint in any second now are the only other two winners who can give Rachel Blackmore anything to worry about. These four are clear now from Discorama and Far Class. They're on to the running now, down to the famous elbow. No female rider has won the Grand National. Rachel Blackmore is out in front. She's just ebbing away energy-wise. Balco Flo in second place. Any second now is back in third position. But one of the great Grand National stories being told on this cold April afternoon. Rachel Blackmore becomes the first female rider to win at the Grand National. What an amazing story.
This is 2FM.